I supposed a strong gust of wind might have set off the alarm, and minutes later I silenced it so I could hear the police arrive. I sat on my bed, waiting. I didn't go through the dreaded routine of securing every inch of my house, of walking into rooms and showers and dark spaces of fear. I listened to silence and became acutely aware of the sounds of it. I heard the wind, the faint clicking of numbers rolling on the digital clock, heat blowing, my own breathing. A car turned into my driveway, and I hurried to the front door as one of the officers sharply rapped with a baton or blackjack instead of ringing the bell. "Police!" a woman's no-nonsense voice announced. I let them in. There were two officers, a young woman and an older man. The woman's nameplate identified her as J.F. Butler, and there was something about her that had an effect on me. "The zone's the one for the kitchen door that leads outside," I told them. "I very much appreciate your coming so quickly."
"What's your name?"
her partner, R.I. McIlwain, asked me. He was acting as if he didn't know who I was, as if I were just a middle-aged lady in a bathrobe who happened to live in a nice house in a neighborhood that rarely needed the police. "Kay Scarpetta?" His tight demeanor loosened a bit, and he said, "I didn't know if you really existed. Heard about you a lot, but I never been to the morgue, not once in 18 years, for which I'm grateful." "That's because back then you didn't have to go to demo posts and learn all these scientific things," Butler picked on him. McIlwain tried not to smile as his eyes roamed curiously around my house. "You're welcome to come watch a demo post any time you want," I said to him. Butler's attention was everywhere, her body on alert. She hadn't been dulled yet by the weight of her career, unlike her partner, whose main interest at this moment was my house and who I was. He had probably pulled 1,000 cars and answered just as many false alarms by now, all for little pay and even less appreciation. "We'd like to look around," Butler said to me, locking the front door, "starting with down here." "Please, look anywhere you want." "If you'll just stay right there," she said, heading toward the kitchen, and then it hit me hard, emotions catching me completely off guard. She reminded me of Lucy. It was the eyes, the straight bridge of the nose, and the way she gestured. Lucy couldn't move her lips without moving her hands, as if she were conducting a conversation instead of having one. I stood in the foyer and could hear their feet on hardwood, their muffled voices, the shutting of doors. They took their time, and I imagined it was Butler who was making sure they didn't ignore a single space big enough to hide a human being. They came down the stairs and went out into the icy night, the beams of their strong flashlights sweeping over windows, streaking across blinds. This went on another 15 minutes, and when they knocked on the door to come back inside, they led me into the kitchen, McIlwain blowing on his cold red hands. Butler had something important on her mind. "Are you aware there's a bent place in the jamb of the kitchen door?" she asked. "No," I said, startled. She unlocked the door near the table by the window where I usually ate when I was with friends or alone. Raw, freezing air rushed in as I moved close to her to see what she was talking about. She shone her light on a small indented impression in the strike plate and edge of the wooden frame, where it appeared someone had tried to pry open the door. "It could have been there for a while and you haven't noticed," she said. "We didn't check when your alarm went off on Tuesday because it was the zone for the garage door." "My alarm went off on Tuesday?" I said in amazement. "I don't know anything about that." "I'm going out to the car," McIlwain said to his partner as he walked out of the kitchen, still rubbing his hands. "Be right back." "I was working day shift," she explained to me. "It appears your housekeeper accidentally set it off." I couldn't understand why Marie would have set off the alarm in the garage, unless she'd gone out that way for some reason and had ignored the warning beep for too long. "She was pretty shook up," Butler went on. "Apparently couldn't remember the code until we were already here." "What time was this?" I asked. "Around 1100 hours. Marino wouldn't have heard the call come over the radio because at 11 o'clock he was in the morgue with me. I thought of the alarm not being set when I got home that night, of the soiled towels and dirt on the rug. I wondered why Marie hadn't left a note for me saying what had happened. "We had no reason to check this door," Butler said, "so I can't say whether the Primark was here on Tuesday or not." Even if it wasn't, I said, obviously someone tried to get in at some point.
Unit 320, Butler said. 10-5 to a precinct B&E detective.
Unit 792, came the response.
Can you respond reference B&E attempt, she said, giving out my address.
10-4, take me about 15 minutes.
Butler set her radio upright on the kitchen table and studied the lock a little more. Cold, gusting air blew a stack of napkins on the floor and sent pages of a newspaper fluttering.
"He's coming out of Meadow and Carey," she told me, as if it were something I ought to know.
"That's where the precinct is." She shut the door.
"They're not part of the detective division anymore," she went on, watching for my reaction.
"So they got moved, are part of uniform operations now. I guess this was about a month ago," she added, as I began to suspect where the conversation was headed.
"I guess B&E detectives are under Deputy Chief Bray now," I said.
She hesitated, then replied with an ironic smile, "Isn't everybody?"
"Would you like a cup of coffee?" I asked.
"That would be nice. I don't want to put you out."
I got a bag of coffee from the freezer. Butler sat down and started filling out an offense report while I got out mugs and cream and sugar, and dispatchers and cops jumped in and out in 10 codes on the air. The doorbell rang and I let the B&E detective in. I didn't know him. It seemed I didn't know anyone anymore since Bray had taken people away from jobs they had learned so well.
"This the door right here?" the detective was asking Butler.
"Yeah.
Hey, Johnny, you got a pen that works better than this?"
A headache began boxing with my brain.
"You got one that works at all?"
I couldn't believe what was going on.
"What's your D.O.B.?" McIlwain was asking me.
"Not too many people have alarm systems in their garage," Butler said.
"In my opinion, the contacts are weaker than they're going to be in a regular door. Lightweight metal, a really big surface area. You get a strong, gusting wind."
"I've never had a strong wind set off the alarm in my garage," I said.
"But if you're a burglar and figure a house has a burglar alarm," Butler continued to reason, "you might not assume the garage door's on it. And maybe there's something in there worth stealing."
"In broad daylight?" I asked.
The detective was dusting the door jamb while more cold air blew in.
"Okay, let's see, Doc," McIlwain continued filling out the report. "Got your home address, need the one downtown, and your home and business telephone numbers."
"I really don't want my unlisted phone number in a press basket," I said, trying to restrain my building resentment of this intrusion, well-intended or not.
"Dr. Scarpetta, you got any prints on file?" the detective asked, brush poised, black magnetic powder dirtying the floor.
"Yes, for exclusionary purposes."
"Thought you might. I think all M.E.s ought to, in case they touch something they're not supposed to," he said,
not intending to insult me, but doing it anyway.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?" I tried to get McIlwain to look up at me and listen.
"I don't want this in the paper. I don't want every news reporter and God knows who else calling me at home and knowing my exact address and my social security number and D.O.B., race, sex, where I was born, height, weight, eye, color, next of kin."
"Anything happened lately we should know about?" McIlwain continued questioning me as Butler handed the detective lifting tape.
"A car followed me Wednesday night," I reluctantly replied. I felt all eyes on me.
"It seems my secretary was followed, too, last night."
McIlwain was writing all of this down, too. The doorbell sounded again, and I saw Marino in the video display of the airphone on the wall by the refrigerator.
"And I'd better not read about that in the paper," I warned, as I walked out of the kitchen.
"No, ma'am. It will be in the supplementary report. That doesn't go in the press basket."
Butler's voice followed me.
"God damn it, do something," I said to Marino as I opened the door. "Someone tries to break into my goddamn house, and now my privacy's going to be broken into next."
Marino was vigorously chewing gum and looked like I was the one who had committed a crime.
"It'd be nice if you'd let me know when someone tries to break into your house. I shouldn't have to hear about it on the fucking scanner," he said,
his angry strides carrying him toward the sound of voices. I'd had enough and retreated to my study to call Marie. A young child answered the phone, then Marie got on.
I just found out about the alarm going off while you were here on Tuesday, I said to her.
I'm very sorry, Mrs. Scarpetta, she said in a pleading voice. I didn't know what to do. I didn't do anything to set it off. I was vacuuming and then it happened. I couldn't remember the code because I was so scared.
I understand, Marie, I said. It scares me, too. It just went off again tonight, so I know exactly what you mean. But I need you to tell me these things when they happen.
The police didn't believe me. I was sure of it. I told them I didn't go into the garage and I could tell.
It's all right, I said again.
I was afraid you would be angry with me because the police... that maybe you wouldn't want me working for you anymore. I should have told you. I will always, I promise.
You don't need to be afraid. The police aren't going to hurt you in this country, Marie. It's not the same thing as where you're from. And I want you to be very careful when you're at my house. Keep the alarm on and make sure it's on when you leave. Did you notice anyone, or maybe a car, that caught your attention for some reason?
I remember it was raining hard and very cold. I didn't see anyone.
You let me know if you do, I said.
29.
Somehow the supplemental part of the attempted burglary offense report made it into the press basket in time for the 6 o'clock news on Saturday night. Reporters began calling both Rose and me at home with question after question about our being followed. I had no doubt Bray was behind that little slip. It was a nice little bit of amusement for her on an otherwise cold, dreary weekend. Of course, she didn't give a damn that my 64-year-old secretary lived alone in a community that did not have a guard gate. Late Sunday afternoon, I sat in my great room, a fire burning, as I worked on a long-overdue journal article that I had no heart for. The wretched weather continued, and my concentration drifted. By now, Joe should have been admitted to MCV, and Lucy should be in D.C., I supposed. I didn't know for sure. But of one thing I was certain— Lucy was angry, and whenever she was angry, she cut herself off from me. It could go on for months, even a year. I had managed to avoid calling my mother or my sister Dorothy, which might have seemed pretty cold of me, but I didn't need one more watt of stress. I finally relented early Sunday evening. Apparently Dorothy wasn't home. I tried my mother next.
"No, Dorothy's not here," my mother said. "She's in Richmond, and maybe you would know that if you ever bothered to call your sister and your mother. Lucy's in a shooting, and you can't be bothered."
"Dorothy's in Richmond?" I said in disbelief.
"What do you expect? She's her mother."
"So Lucy's in Richmond, too?" The thought sliced through me like a scalpel. "That's why her mother's going there. Of course Lucy's in Richmond." I didn't know why I should have been surprised. Dorothy was a narcissistic upstager. Whenever there was drama, she had to be the center of it. If that meant suddenly assuming the role of mother to a child she cared nothing about, Dorothy would.
"She left yesterday and didn't want to bother to ask about staying in your house since you don't seem to care about your family," my mother said.
"Dorothy never wants to stay in my house." My sister was quite fond of hotel bars. At my house, there was no possibility of meeting men— at least not any I was willing to share with her. "Where's she staying?" I asked. "And is Lucy staying with her?"
"No one will tell me. All this secrecy business, and here I am, her grandmother."
I couldn't stand it anymore. "Mother, I've got to go," I said. I practically hung up on her and called the orthopedic department chair, Dr. Graham Worth, at home. "Graham, you've got to help me out," I told him. "Don't tell me a patient in my unit died," he wryly said. "Graham, you know I wouldn't ask for your help unless it was something very important." Levity gave way to silence. "You've got a patient under an alias. She's ATF, was shot in Miami. You know who I mean." He didn't answer me. "My niece Lucy was involved in the same shooting," I went on.
"I know about the shooting," he replied. "Certainly it's been in the news."
"I'm the one who asked Joe Sanders, ATF supervisor, to transfer her to MCV. I promised to personally look after her, Graham."
"Listen, Kay," he said. "I've been instructed that under no circumstances am I allowed to let anyone but immediate family in to see her."
"No one else?" I said in disbelief. "Not even my niece?" He paused, then said,
It pains me to tell you this, but especially not her.
Why, that's ridiculous.
It's not my call.
I couldn't imagine Lucy's reaction if she was being barred from seeing her lover.
She's got a shattered, comminuted fracture of the left femur, he was explaining. I've had to put in a plate. She's in traction and on morphine, Kay. She fades in and out. Only her parents are seeing her. I'm not even sure she really understands where she is or what happened to her.
What about the head injury? I asked.
Just a grazing wound that opened the flesh.
Has Lucy been there at all, maybe waiting outside the room? Her mother might be with her.
She was there earlier, alone, Dr. Worth replied, sometime this morning. I doubt she's still there.
At least give me a chance to talk to Joe's parents. He wouldn't answer me.
Graham?
Silence. For God's sake. They're comrades. They're best friends.
Silence. Are you still there?
Yes.
Damn it, Graham, they love each other. Joe might not even know if Lucy's alive.
Joe is very well aware your niece is fine. Joe doesn't want to see her, he said. I got off the phone and stared at it. Somewhere in this goddamn city, my sister was checked into a hotel, and she knew where Lucy was. I went through the yellow pages, starting with the Omni, the Jefferson, the obvious hotels. I soon found that Dorothy had checked into the Berkeley in the historic area of the city known as Shaco Slip. She didn't answer the phone in her room. There were only so many places in Richmond where she could carouse on a Sunday, and I hurried out of the house and got into my car. The skyline was shrouded in clouds, and I valet-parked my car in front of the Berkeley. I knew right away when I walked inside that Dorothy would not be here. The small, elegant hotel had an intimate dark bar with high-backed leather chairs and a quiet clientele. The bartender wore a white jacket and was very attentive when I went up to him. "I'm looking for my sister and wonder if she's been in here," I said. I described her, and he shook his head. I walked back outside and crossed the cobblestone street to the tobacco company, an old tobacco warehouse that had been turned into a restaurant with an exposed glass and brass elevator constantly gliding up and down through an atrium of lush plants and exotic flowers. Just inside the front door was a piano bar with a dance floor, and I spotted Dorothy sitting at a table crowded with five men. I walked up to them, clearly on a mission. People at nearby tables stopped talking, all eyes on me as if I were a gunslinger who had just pushed her way through a saloon's swinging doors. "Excuse me," I politely said to the man on Dorothy's left. "Do you mind if I sit here for a moment?" He did mind, but he surrendered his chair and wandered off to the bar. Dorothy's other companions shifted about uncomfortably. "I've come to get you," I said to Dorothy, who clearly had been drinking for a while.
"Well, look who's here," she exclaimed, and she raised her stinger in a toast. "My big sister. Let me introduce you," she said to her companions.
"Be quiet and listen to me," I said in a low voice.
"My legendary big sister."
Dorothy always got mean when she drank. She didn't slur her words or bump into things, but she could sexually tease men into misery and use her tongue like a nettle. I was ashamed of her demeanor and the way she dressed, which sometimes seemed an intended parody of me. This night she wore the handsome dark blue suit of a professional, but beneath the jacket her tight pink sweater offered her companions more than a hint of nipples. Dorothy had always been obsessed with her small breasts. To have men staring at them somehow reassured her. "Dorothy," I said, leaning closer to her ear, almost overwhelmed by Chanel Coco, "you need to come with me. We have to talk."
"Do you know who she is?" she went on as I cringed. "The chief medical examiner of this fine commonwealth. Can you believe it? I have a big sister who's a coroner."
"Wow, that's got to be really interesting," one of the men said.
"What can I get you to drink?"
said another. "So what do you think is the truth about the Ramsey case? Think the parents did it?"
"I'd like somebody to prove those were really Amelia Earhart's bones they found. Where's a waitress?"
I put my hand on Dorothy's arm and we got up from the table. One thing was true about my sister. She had too much pride to cause a scene that didn't make her look clever and appealing. I escorted her out into a dispirited night of darkened windows and fog.
"I'm not going home with you," she announced, now that there was no one to hear. "And let go of my fucking arm." She pulled in the direction of her hotel while I tugged her toward my car. "You're coming with me, and we're going to figure out what to do about Lucy." "I saw her earlier at the hospital," she said. I put her in the passenger's side. "She didn't mention anything about you," my ever-sensitive sister said. I got in and locked the doors. "Joe's parents are very sweet," she added as we drove off. "I was very taken aback that they didn't know the truth about Lucy and Joe's relationship."
"What did you do, tell them, Dorothy?"
"Not in so many words, but I suppose I implied certain things because I just assumed they knew. You know, it seems so odd to see a skyline like this when you're used to Miami."
I wanted to slap her.
"Anyway, after talking with the Sanderses for a while, I came to realize they're the Jerry Falwell type and weren't about to condone a lesbian relationship."
"I wish you wouldn't use that word."
"Well, that's what they are. Descended from the Amazon types on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea off the coast of Turkey. Turkish women have so much hair. You ever noticed?"
"You ever heard of Sappho?"
"Of course I've heard of him," Dorothy said. "She was a lesbian because she lived on Lesbos. She was one of the greatest lyric poets in antiquity." "Ha! Nothing poetic about some of these body-pierced, stocky hockey players, I see. And, of course, the Sanderses didn't come right out and say they thought Lucy and Joe were lesbians. Their reasoning was Joe had been horribly traumatized, and to see Lucy would bring it all back. It was too soon. They were quite emphatic in a very nice way, and when Lucy showed up, they were very kind and sympathetic when they told her."
I passed through the toll plaza.
"Unfortunately, you know how Lucy is. She challenged them. She said she didn't believe them and got pretty loud and rude. I explained to the Sanderses that she was just very upset after all she'd been through. They were very patient and said they'd pray for her, and next thing I knew, a nurse told Lucy she had to leave. She stormed out," my sister said. She looked over at me to add, "Of course, mad at you or not, she'll come looking for you just like she always does."
"How could you do that to her?"
I asked.
"How could you get between her and Joe? What kind of person are you?"
Dorothy was taken aback. I could feel her bristle. "You've always been so jealous of me because you're not her mother," she answered. I turned off on the Meadow Street exit instead of keeping on toward home.
"Why don't we just settle this once and for all?" Dorothy and her stingers said.
"You're nothing but a machine, a computer, one of those high-tech instruments you love so much. And one has to ask what's wrong with a person who chooses to spend all her time with dead people? Refrigerated, stinky, rotting, dead people? Most of them lowlifes to begin with."
I got on the downtown expressway again, heading back downtown.
"Versus me. I believe in relationships. I spend my time in creative pursuits, in reflection and relationships, and I believe our bodies are our temples and we should take care of them and be proud of them. Look at you."
She paused for effect.
"You smoke, you drink, you don't even belong to a gym, I bet. Don't ask me why you're not fat and flabby, unless it's cutting through all those ribs and running around crime scenes, or being on your feet all day in a goddamn morgue. But let's get to what the worst thing is."
She leaned close to me, her vodka breath an unpleasant vapor.
"Fasten your shoulder harness, Dorothy," I quietly said. "What you've done to my daughter, my only child. You never had a child because you've always been too busy, so you took mine."
She blasted me with her boozy breath.
"I should have never, never, ever let her visit you. Where was my brain when I let her stay summers with you?"
She dramatically clutched her head in both hands.
"You filled her with all this guns and ammo and crime-solving shit. You turned her into a fucking little computer nerd by the time she was 10, when little girls should be going to birthday parties and riding ponies and making friends."
I let her rail on, paying attention to the road.
"You exposed her to a big, ugly redneck cop, and let's face it, he's really your only close relationship with a man. I hope like hell you don't sleep with a pig like that. And I have to tell you, as sorry as I am about what happened to Benton, he was weak. Not enough sap in that tree. Oh, no, no yolk in that egg. Huh, you were the man in that relationship, Miss Doctor Lawyer Chief. I've told you before, and I'll tell you again, you're nothing but a man with big tits. You fool everybody because you look so elegant in your Ralph Lauren and ritzy-titsy car.
You think you're so fucking sexy with those big tits, always making me feel something's wrong with me and making fun of me when I ordered Mark Eden and all those other contraptions. And remember what Mother said? She gave me a photograph of a man's hairy hand and said that's what makes a woman's breasts get big.
You're drunk, I said.
We were teenagers and you made fun of me.
I never made fun of you.
You made me feel stupid and ugly. And you had this blonde hair and a chest and all the boys talked about you. Especially since you were smart, too. Oh, you've always thought you're so fucking smart because I couldn't do anything but English.
Stop it, Dorothy.
I hate you.
No, you don't, Dorothy.
But you don't fool me. Oh, no.
She shook her head side to side, wagging her finger in my face.
Oh, no. You can't fool me. I've always suspected the truth about you.
I was parked in front of the Berkeley Hotel, and she didn't even notice. She was screaming, tears streaming down her face.
You're a closet diesel dyke, she said hatefully. And you turned my daughter into one. And now she almost gets killed and she thinks I'm lower than a sewer.
Why don't you go inside your hotel and get some sleep? I said to her. She wiped her eyes and looked out the window, surprised to see her hotel, as if it were a spaceship that had silently landed. I'm not dumping you out on the roadside, Dorothy, but right now I think it's best we're not together. She sniffled, her rage fading like fireworks in the night. I'll get you to your room, I said. She shook her head, her hands motionless in her lap, tears sliding down her miserable face.
She didn't want to see me, she said in a voice as quiet as a breath. The minute I came off the elevator in that hospital, she looked as if someone had just spat on her food.
A group of people were walking out of the tobacco company. I recognized the men who had been at Dorothy's table. They were walking unsteadily and laughing too loudly.
She's always wanted to be just like you, Kay. Do you have any idea how that feels? She cried. I'm a somebody, too. Why can't she want to be like me?
She suddenly moved over and hugged me. She cried into my neck, sobbing, shaking. I wanted to love her. But I didn't. I never had.
I want her to adore me, too, she exclaimed,
carried away by emotion and alcohol and her own addiction to drama.
I want her to admire me, too. I want her to brag about me like she does you. I want her to think I'm brilliant and strong, that everyone turns around and looks at me when I walk into a room. I want her to think and say all those things she thinks and says about you. I want her to ask my advice and want to grow up to be just like me.
I put the car in gear and drove up to the entrance of the hotel.
Dorothy, I said, you're the most selfish person I've ever known.
30. It was almost 9 o'clock by the time I got home, and I worried that I should have brought Dorothy with me instead of leaving her at the hotel. I wouldn't have been the least bit surprised if she had gone right back across the street to the bar. Maybe there were a few lonely men left she could amuse. I checked my telephone messages, annoyed by hang-ups. There were 7 of them, and the caller ID read unavailable each time. Reporters didn't like to leave messages, even at my office, because it gave me the option of not calling them back. I heard a car door shut in the driveway and almost wondered if it were Dorothy. But when I checked, a yellow taxi was driving away as Lucy rang the bell. She was carrying 1 small suitcase and a tote bag and dropped them in the foyer, shoving the door shut without hugging me. Her left cheek was 1 dark purple bruise, and several smaller ones were beginning to turn yellow at the edges. I had seen enough injuries like that to know she had been punched. "I hate her," she started in, glaring at me as if I were to blame. "Who told her to come here? Was it you?" "You know I would never do something like that," I said. "Come on, let's talk. We have so much talking to do. My God, I was beginning to think I was never going to see you again." I sat her in front of the fire and tossed in another log. Lucy looked awful. She had dark circles under her eyes. Her jeans and sweater were hanging off her. Her reddish-brown hair was falling over her face. She propped a foot up on my coffee table. Velcro ripped as she took off her ankle holster and gun. "You got anything to drink in this house?" she asked. "Some bourbon or something?" There was no damn heat in the back of the taxi and the window wouldn't close. "I'm frozen. Look at my hands." She held them out. The nails were blue. I took both of them in mine and held them tight. I moved closer to her on the couch and put my arms around her again. She felt so thin. "What happened to all that muscle?" I tried to be funny. "I haven't had much food." She stared into the fire. "They don't have food in Miami?" She wouldn't smile. "Why did Mother have to come? Why can't she just leave me alone? All my life she doesn't do a goddamn fucking thing except subject me to all her men, men, men," she said. "Parade herself around with all these dicks fawning over her while I had nobody. Hell, they had nobody either and didn't even know it." "You've always had me." She shoved her hair out of her eyes and didn't seem to hear me. "You know what she did at the hospital?" "How did she know where to find you?" I had to have that question answered first, and Lucy knew why I asked it. "Because she's my birth mother," she said with sing-song sarcasm. "So she's listed on various forms, whether I like it or not, and of course she knows who Joe is. So Mom tracks down Joe's parents here in Richmond and finds out everything because she's so manipulative and people always think she's wonderful. The Sanderses tell her where Joe's room is, and Mother shows up at the hospital this morning, and I didn't even know she was here until I was sitting there in the waiting area, and she walked in like the prima donna she is." She clenched and unclenched her fists, as if her fingers were stiff. "Then guess what?" she went on. "Mom puts on this big sympathetic act with the Sanderses, is bringing them coffee, sandwiches, giving them all her little pearls of philosophy. And they're talking and talking, and I'm just sitting there like I don't exist. And then Mom comes over and pats my hand and says, 'Joe isn't having any visitors today.' I ask her who the hell she is telling me that. She says the Sanderses wanted her to tell me because they didn't want to hurt my feelings. So I finally just fucking leave. Mom may still be there for all I know." "She's not," I said. Lucy got up and stabbed a log with the poker. Sparks swarmed as if in protest. "She's gone too far. This time she's done it," my niece said. "Let's don't talk about her. I want to talk about you. Tell me what happened in Miami." She sat on the rug, leaning against the couch, staring into the fire. I got up and went to the bar and poured her a Booker's bourbon. "Aunt Kay, I've got to see her." I handed Lucy the drink and sat back down. I massaged her shoulders and she began to loosen up, her voice getting drowsy. "She's in there and doesn't know I'm waiting for her. Maybe she thinks I can't be bothered." "Why in the world would she think that, Lucy?" She didn't answer me, but seemed drawn into smoke and flames. She sipped her drink. "When we were driving there in my hot little V12 Benz," she said in a distant voice, "Joe had this bad feeling and she told me she did. I said it was normal to have a bad feeling when you're about to do a takedown. I even kidded her about it." She paused, just staring at flames as if she were seeing something else. "We get to the door of the apartment that these 165er assholes are using as their clubhouse," she resumed, "and Joe goes first. There are six of them in there instead of three. Right away we know we're had, and I know what they're going to do. One of them grabs Joe and sticks a gun to her head to make her tell them where the Fisher Island place is we'd set up for the hit." She took a deep breath and was silent, as if she couldn't go on. She sipped the bourbon. "God, what is this stuff? The vapors alone are knocking me out. 120 proof. Usually I'm not a pusher, but it wouldn't be such a bad thing for you to be knocked out right now. Stay here with me for a while," I said. "ATF and DEA did everything right," she told me. "These things happen, Lucy." I had to think fast. The only thing I knew to do was act like I didn't care if they blew her brains out or not. Here they are holding a gun to her head, and I start acting pissed off at her, which wasn't at all what they were expecting. She took another swallow of bourbon. It was hitting her hard. "I walked up to this Moroccan asshole with the gun and get right in his face and tell him to go ahead and waste her, that she's a stupid bitch and I'm sick of her always getting in my way. But if he does her now, all he's going to do is fuck himself and everybody else." She stared into the fire, eyes wide and unblinking, as if watching it again in her mind. "I say, you think I didn't expect you would use us and then do this? You think I'm stupid? Well, guess what? I forgot to tell you Mr. Tortora is expecting our company," and I look at my watch. "In exactly 1 hour and 16 minutes. I thought it would be nice to entertain him before you motherfuckers showed up and blew his guts out and took all his guns and money and fucking cocaine. What happens if we don't show up? You think he won't get nervous? I couldn't take my eyes off Lucy. Images flew at me from all directions. I imagined her playing out this dangerous act, and I saw her in battle dress when she was at fire scenes and flying a helicopter and programming computers. I envisioned her as the irritating, irrepressible child I had virtually raised. Marina was right. Lucy thought she had so much to prove. Her first impulse had always been to fight. "I didn't think they really believed me," she said. "So I turned to Joe. I'll never forget the look in her eyes, the pistol barrel right against her temple. Her eyes," she paused. "They're so calm as she looks in mine because," her voice shook, "because she wants me to know she loves me." Lucy chokes on sobs. "She loves me. She wants me to know because she believes," her voice went up and stopped, "she believes we're going to die. And that's when I start yelling at her. I call her a stupid fucking bitch and slap her face so hard my hand goes numb. And she just looks at me as if I'm all there is, blood trickling out of her nose and the sides of her mouth, a red river down her face, dripping off her chin. She didn't even cry. She's out of the story, lost her role, her training, everything she damn well knows what to do. I grab her. I shove her hard to the ground and get on top of her, swearing and slapping and yelling. She wiped her eyes and stared straight ahead. "And what's so awful, Aunt Kay, is part of it's real. I'm so angry with her for quitting on me, for just giving up. She was going to just give up and die, God damn it." "Like Benton did," I quietly said. Lucy wiped her face on her shirt. She didn't seem to hear what I'd said. "I'm so fucking tired of people giving up and leaving me," she said in a shattered voice. "When I need them, and they fucking give up." "Benton didn't give up, Lucy. I just keep swearing at Joe, screaming and hitting her and telling her I'm going to kill her as I straddle her, shaking her by her hair. It wakes her up, maybe even pisses her off, too, and she starts fighting back. Calls me a Cuban cunt and spits blood in my face, punches me, and by this time the guys are laughing and whistling and grabbing their crotches." She took another long breath and shut her eyes, barely able to sit up. She leaned against my legs, firelight playing on her strong, beautiful face. She starts really struggling. My knees are so tight against her sides, I'm surprised I didn't break her ribs. And while we're going at each other like that, I tear open her shirt, and this really gets the guys going, and they don't see me grab my gun out of my ankle holster. I start firing. I just fire, 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 fire. Her voice trailed off. I bent over and put my arms around her. "You know, I'm wearing those wide-legged street jeans to hide my cig. They say I fired 11 rounds. I don't even remember dropping the empty magazine, putting in a full one, racking it back. Agents are everywhere, and somehow I'm dragging Joe out the door, and she's bleeding heavily from her head." Lucy's lower lip trembled as she tried to go on, her voice far away. She wasn't here. She was there, living it again. "Fire, fire, fire. Her blood on my hands." Her voice rose to God. "I hit her and hit her. I can still feel the sting of her cheek against the palm of my hand." She looked at her hand as if it should be put to death. I felt it, how soft her skin was. And she bled. I made her bleed. The skin I had touched and loved. I drew blood from it. Then the guns, the guns, the guns, and smoke and ringing in my ears, and it's a blaze when it happens like that. It's over and never started. I knew she was dead. She bowed her head and wept quietly, and I stroked her hair. "You saved her life, and you saved yours," I finally said. "Joe knows what you did and why you did it, Lucy. She should love you all the more." "I'm in trouble this time, Aunt Kay," she said. "You're a hero. That's what you are." "No. You don't understand. It doesn't matter if it was a good shooting. It doesn't matter if ATF gives me a medal." She sat up and got to her feet. She stared down at me with defeat in her eyes and another emotion I didn't recognize. Maybe it was grief. She'd never shown grief when Benton was murdered. All I'd ever seen was rage. The bullet they took out of her leg? It's a Hornady custom jacketed hollow point, 90 grains. What I had in my gun. I didn't know what to say. I'm the one who shot her, Aunt Kay. Even if you did, what if she never walks again? What if she's finished in law enforcement because of me? She won't be jumping out of helicopters anytime soon, I said. But she's going to be fine. What if I permanently damaged her face with my fucking fist? Lucy, listen to me, I said. You saved her life. If you killed two people to do that, then so be it. You had no choice. It's not that you wanted to... The hell I didn't, she said. I wish I'd killed all of them. You don't mean that. Maybe I'll just be a mercenary soldier, she bitterly said. Got any murderers, rapists, carjackers, pedophiles, drug dealers you need to get rid of? Just call 1-800-LUCY. You can't bring Benton back through killing. Still, it was as if she didn't hear me. He wouldn't want you to feel this way, I said. The telephone rang. He didn't abandon you, Lucy. Don't be angry with him because he died. The phone rang a third time, and she couldn't restrain herself. She grabbed it, unable to hide the hope and fear in her eyes. I couldn't bring myself to tell her what Dr. Worth had told me. Now was not the time. Sure, hold on, she said, and disappointment and more hurt touched her face as she handed me the phone. Yes, I reluctantly answered. Is this Dr. K. Scarpetta? An unfamiliar male voice asked. Who is this? It's important I verify who you are. The accent was American. If you're another reporter, I'm going to give you a phone number. I'm going to give you a promise, I said. Tell me who you are, or I'm hanging up. Let me give you this number. And he began reciting it before I could refuse. I recognized the country code for France. It's 3 o'clock in the morning in France, I said, as if he didn't know. It doesn't matter what time it is. We have been getting information from you and running it through our computer system. Not from me. No, not in the sense that you typed it into the computer, Dr. Scarpetta. His voice was baritone and smooth, like fine, polished wood. I'm at the Secretariat in Lyon, he informed me. Call the number I gave you and at least get our after-hours voicemail. How much sense does that please? I hung up and tried, and a recording of a woman with a heavy French accent said, Bonjour, hello, and gave the office hours in both languages. I entered the extension he had given me, and the man's voice came back over the line. Bonjour, hello, and that's supposed to identify who you are? I said. You could be a restaurant for all I know. Please, fax me a sheet of your letterhead. When I see that, I'll fill you in. He gave me the number. I put him on hold and went back to my study.